In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast, 5 fitness tips for newlyweds using Jack Daniel's running formula, morning versus evening workouts, the benefits of protein fasting, how to fix bad posture from working on a computer, and much more.
Welcome to the BenGreenfieldFitness.com podcast. We provide you with free exercise, nutrition, weight loss, triathlon, and wellness advice from the top fitness experts in the nation. So whether you're an Ironman triathlete or you're just trying to shed a few pounds, get ready for non-run-of-the-mill, cutting-edge content from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
Beep, 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 beep. You know what I'm doing? Beep, beep.
No. I give up.
I'm a moving truck backing up.
Oh, yes. You're alluding to... creatively alluding to the fact that I am surrounded by moving boxes right now.
It was hard to make a sound like a box, so I thought I'd choose the truck instead.
Yeah, box sounds are tough. I got it now. I get the truck.
My humor illusion is just too highbrow.
That's what the moving trucks sound like in Canada, huh?
Yes.
It's actually just a dude.
It's a French guy strapped to the back of the truck yelling, beep, beep, beep.
Doesn't he yell it in a French accent? So it's a little bit more like,
oh, I'm saying
beep,
in French.
Beep, beep, beep.
Dude, that's racist.
Sorry. Yeah, so I'm moving on Friday. I've got the entire house packed up. Literally, like, we're living out of boxes right now. And we're moving into our new home that we've been hacking together for the past year out in the forest in Washington. So we'll disappear up to there. And you know what might be the best part about this for our podcast listeners?
I thought it was the French guy strapped to the back of the truck.
Aside from the French guy strapped to the back of the moving truck.
What's the best part?
My new office is soundproofed.
Mm.
So, yeah. Yeah,
no, not more dogs only does barking, it, no more children screaming in the background.
Yeah, it looks out into the forest and the tamarack trees and everything, and it's soundproof, so no toilets flushing or dogs barking. So it'll be nice.
Hey, to anybody who hasn't listened to the latest Obstacle Dominator podcast, if you listen closely when nobody's talking, you can hear crickets.
Mm.
I don't know whose end that was on, but it was very soothing.
That's actually the sound of our complete lack of listeners to that podcast.
News flashes.
So, Brock, you were telling me about how we've gotten some complaints about typos on my Twitter feed.
Yes. Yeah. People writing back to you, sending out links to like Plus One or PubMed or Biohackers blog and correcting, like saying, oh, you've got a spelling mistake in the third paragraph.
Of the article? Yeah. I don't actually write all the articles that
not
I tweet
all of
out.
The articles, and especially not the ones that are scientific studies on Plus One and.
That's right. I just read the articles and tweet to them. So,
So these are them. These are the tweeted articles that you did.
These
not,
are
right?
them. I take no responsibility for spelling mistakes. The first one, actually, this was a really interesting article that I think anybody, I think anybody should go read it. But I especially think people who are dealing with resistance to the ability to lose fat really need to go read this, because it was one of the best synopses of all of like the hidden reasons that you're unable to lose fat that I've ever seen, laid out in a really nice scientific format. So it's a really good article. It appeared in the journal Obesity Treatment, and the title of the article is "What Are We Putting in Our Food That Is Making Us Fat? Food Additives, Contaminants, and Other Putative Contributors to Obesity."
Putative.
I think we all need to use the word putative more.
Yeah, I'm going to tattoo that on my arm.
What does putative mean?
I have no idea. No. Actually, I was hoping you knew.
I'm going to admit that I actually don't know what the word putative
means. I am looking it up.
Okay, you look up the word putative while I talk about this actual article.
Generally considered or reputed to be.
There we go.
The putative father of a boy of two. Hey, that's you.
Thank you for using in a sentence, Brock.
Yes.
So what this article goes into are all of the non-traditional factors that can contribute to obesity. And it goes into a bunch of them that go above and beyond what we just find in our food, like emotional stress, sleep deprivation, disruption of circadian rhythms, composition of the gut microbiome, oxidative stress, medications, the average temperature in your home, environmental toxicants. Like, it goes on and on before it even gets to the food stuff. So first of all, that's really interesting, just being able to look at the actual scientific evidence about how something as simple as the temperature in your home and consistently living in a comfortable environment has been scientifically shown to contribute to your ability to be able to lose or not lose weight. And then it jumps into a lot of the things in foods that could not just cause obesity, but also things that could prevent obesity and some of the differences between the two. So, for example, they do mention that there are some things called hydrocolloids that they put in food, like guar gum and something called beta-glucan. And those can actually help to increase satiety and reduce caloric intake because they have these like bulking properties. And these would be things that could actually help you to stay fuller for longer. They also point out all the evidence that all the color compounds and things like grapes and purple corn and blueberries and plants, the anthocyanins in these things, that can help to prevent obesity as well. We always think of these as antioxidants, but they've also got some pretty cool anti-obesity properties also. But then they point out that there are subtle differences in these compounds that you also want to pay attention to. Like I mentioned, how a bulking agent like guar gum or beta-glucan can help you to lose weight by increasing satiety. Mm-hmm. If we look at another common bulking agent, one called carrageenan, which you've probably seen before. You'll find it in like some coconut milks. You'll find it in a lot of packaged compounds. It's in things like even like ice cream. You'll find it in coconut ice cream, or what we call vegan ice cream. That's actually been shown to contribute to insulin resistance compared to something like guar gum. So it's really interesting, all these slight and subtle nuances that you can look at in terms of food additives. Now, some of the biggies that actually do directly contribute to obesity that go above and beyond the ones that we would already know about, right? Like high fructose corn syrup and sucrose and trans fats. Like, we all kind of sort of know that maybe we shouldn't be eating those, but it delves into the scientific literature that shows that things like sodium benzoate, which you find in fruit juices and salad dressing, that can decrease leptin release, which is one of the things that's responsible for regulating appetite. It talks about sodium sulfite, which you find, interestingly, in wine, which can actually cause what's called a lipopolysaccharide-induced interleukin-6 secretion. Which causes, I know,
it makes me gasp.
The sharp intake of breath, like you know what it means. It just sounds bad.
It sounds terrible.
Anyways, though, that if you listen to the podcast episode that we did with Dr. Kate Shanahan, that type of inflammation, any type of inflammation, really keeps fat cells from dying. So when you exercise or when you like maybe do some fasting and some cold exposure, all that stuff can cause fat cells to die, but it won't happen if you're inflamed. And sodium sulfite, which you do find in a lot of sulfite-rich wines, it's a preservative that they add to wines, that's something that can inhibit that process from occurring. There's
so
some
if
other
I'm sitting on the couch
things.
Wearing my cool fat burner vest and having a glass of wine at the same time, they're sort of negating each other.
You know what? I actually drink ice water when I'm wearing that vest. And
I thought you were going to say ice wine.
No, but there are some wines, like a lot of organic wines, they don't have this sodium sulfite in them. So again, I'm not saying like you shouldn't drink wine. I'm just saying you should kind of choose it carefully. So, some other things that they talk about, like what are called perfluorinated compounds. A lot of people out there, like, you know, paleo enthusiasts and stuff, they're eating sardines. Well, if you're getting sardines that are not like the organic sardines packed in the healthy cans, you know, like the Bella brand is a good brand, or like the Wild Planet sardines would be another. They've got these perfluorinated compounds in them, which are actually stored in adipose tissue. So your body makes new fat cells to store what you're getting in your canned sardines if you're just choosing whatever happens to be on sale at the grocery store. So I mean, like, I don't want to be the person who's just like, you know, trying to scare tactic people into worrying constantly about the food that you're putting into your mouth. But this stuff does matter. Like, if all you're doing is shopping at Costco and the bargain bin of the grocery store, like, you're saving money. But if you're trying to lose weight, you may want to consider choosing the stuff that has the better ingredients. And then, of course, trying as much as possible to choose the stuff that doesn't need any of these ingredients added to it at all, you know. Yeah. The shop at the organic farmers market approach when you can. And again, I know not all people have the ability to be able to do that, but I mean, like, there are sources out there. You can order organic bone broth from the brothery, and you can order, like, you know, organic meats from US Wellness Meats. I mean, even if you live in a complete healthy grocery store oasis, like, you know, I don't know, downtown Las Vegas or something, mm-hmm. for all of our podcast listeners who are living in the Trump Tower. You can still find some healthy stuff. So go read the article. It's interesting. We'll link to it in the show notes at bengreenfieldfitness.com/291. Another interesting one for you female triathletes out there. I tweeted.
You pissed off a lot of ladies on Facebook. Have you looked at the comments in there?
Just briefly.
The word uterus, I've never seen it come up that angrily and that often in a thread in my life.
Uterus.
Uterus!
So this research team at Loyola University, they looked at a bunch of female triathletes and released a new study that found that female triathletes are at risk of pelvic floor disorders like urinary and bowel incontinence, female athlete triad syndrome, menstrual problems, abnormal bone density, and at a way higher level than, you know, quote unquote, normal members of the population. They found that 1 in 4 female triathletes had at least one symptom of female athlete triad syndrome, which is, you know, low bone density, an eating disorder, and irregular menstruation. So really, really concerning factors here. And I mean, like, the whole, like, pelvic floor disorder issue, I see that a ton in the female athletes that I work with. Even if you don't see hormonal imbalances, you see low back pain, you see sciatica, you see urinary incontinence, you see pelvic floor issues. And honestly, a big, big part of this, I find, is that female triathletes are omitting, or however you want to look at it, committing or omitting two errors. Number one, they aren't lifting heavy stuff enough. So they don't develop that type of core strength, that type of inner strength necessary for the body to be able to withstand the buffeting that takes place with the chronic repetitive motion of running and cycling, especially. And then the other thing that they're not doing is they're not eating enough good nutrient dense food. You know, and instead opting for scones and dark chocolate. So basically, I think that any female triathlete should go and read this article. And, you know, it certainly gives me pause when I see the number of female endurance athletes that have pelvic organ prolapse, which is the bulging of one or more pelvic organs into the vagina. And I'm quoting that off of the study. Weird. So, you know, that doesn't to me sound like a very pleasant thing. So if you are concerned about the bulging of your pelvic organs into your vagina, or you're a female athlete or someone looking to get into triathlon, like, I'm a triathlete and I'm all for triathlon, but man, you got to take care of your body. You can't just go pound the pavement and swim and bike and, you know, eat the average endurance athlete diet and expect for your body to withstand the rigors of that. So, I mean, it's one of the reasons that I wrote, and I tweeted this, it's one of the reasons I wrote, like, my tri-ripped triathlon training program that's like a combination of weight training and really nutrient-dense eating and triathlon training. And it's also one of the reasons I wrote my Beyond Training book. Like, you need to take advantage of those resources if you're going to go out and do this to your body. So, study finds female triathletes are at risk of numerous health complications. Check it out.
And not their uterus falling out.
Yes. Yes. That people were saying that their uterus is going to fall out?
Well, that's the old belief. That's why the women weren't allowed to do marathon in the Olympics until like 15 years ago or whatever it was, because there was a rumor that their uterus would fall out. So that was the first thing that people sort of jumped on this whole, this article about.
Just like fall out and start flopping around in the street.
I get to scurry off into the forest.
Into the bushes. Wow. All right. We've just offended a lot of women. So
yeah, we offended the French. Now we offended the women.
See, anyways, this next study is applicable to both sexes. So this was really interesting. It appeared in this week's Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research. And what they did was they did a systematic review of all the different studies out there that look at what happens to your heart rate when you're exercising in the heat. And the interesting thing was that once you put all of the studies together that look into your heart rate and exercising in the heat and the actual percentage of your body mass that you lose, like whether you're losing like 1 or 2 or 3% of your body mass during like a run or a marathon or a tough workout in the heat or a triathlon or something like that, they actually came up with an equation that shows that on average for every 1% of your body mass that you lose, your heart rate is going to rise by 3 beats per minute. Now, I'm not just saying this to be nerdy and wear my math man propeller hat. The reason I'm doing this is, or saying this is, because so many people will go into, let's say you're doing an Ironman triathlon, right? So you go in and you have this heart rate that you plan on being at for the marathon. But by the time you get to the marathon of that triathlon, you have lost 2% of your body mass, which is not unreasonable.
No.
Okay. So especially if you're competing in the heat. Well, that would mean that whatever heart rate you've plugged into your heart rate monitor, that's like your goal heart rate zone for that run, it's going to be, because there's a 3 beat increase for every 1% of body mass loss, it's going to be 6 beats off. Right. So if normally, under normal circumstances, your money zone that you know you can run a marathon really good at is 142 to 148 beats per minute. Well, now it's going to be 148 to 154 beats per minute because it's going to change by 6 beats. So the way that you can practically apply this is, if you're training for some kind of an event, then during some of your training sessions, weigh yourself before and after. Figure out how much body mass you lose when you're taking in about how much water you plan on taking in during the event, and then adjust your heart rate accordingly. Like, plan ahead and know, okay, well, technically I need to shove all my heart rate zones forward by 6 beats or forward by 9 beats, based on the fact that by the time I start this run, or as I'm getting into this run, or when I'm halfway through this run, I'm going to have lost, like, you know, 1 to 2% of my body mass. So really interesting. Cool. Yeah. Yeah. So it's a little equation, 1% body mass loss, 3 beats per minute. So get out your calculators.
Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life. You don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses, and keeping your mitochondria strong, it's one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is, most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard, because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full-spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements, because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. It's just 2 bottles. I keep them in my pantry, throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order. Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You got to check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth, contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their sexual performance booster, again, by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up, because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use this special form of a workout called a rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office. My cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. Carolbike.com.
Listener Q&A.
Hi Ben, my name's Robbie Ferroni and I'm talking to you on behalf of one of your biggest fans and my soon-to-be wed brother, Marco. His fiancée Jasmine and I were wondering what your top marriage tips would be for someone who loves all things triathlon, nutrition, and Ben Greenfield.
Don't do it, Marco.
Yes, Marco, run.
I don't know Jasmine, but I'm sure she's evil.
I'm sure she's a nice girl, but... yeah. Seriously though, I mean, like, if you're gonna get married, probably the best things I could recommend to you would be to get like a little tandem bicycle for two. Mm-hmm. And maybe like if you're a triathlete and you're into like triathlon, which it sounds like you are, Marco, maybe like a swim tether. You could like tether each other together one of those leashes for running. So that would also work well. So you're able to stay together when you run. No, I'm kidding. You don't need a tandem bike and a swim tether and a running leash to be happy.
Straight for the surgery and just sew yourself to the other person.
I'll give you 5 tips. I'll give you 5 kind of like newlywed fitness tips. And I've been happily married for 11 years. So I haven't messed up yet, but I'll give you a few of the tips that I wish I'd have known when I got married. The first years? Thing. Yeah, 11 years, man.
I've had a t-shirt for longer than that. That's not impressive.
All right. So first of all, this is kind of more of a nutrition tip than a fitness tip. But I would say, first of all, cook together. Like, when one person does the cooking in the home, it really does create a little bit of a disconnect. And possibly if it's Jasmine doing a lot of the cooking, or you, I guess, like a little bit of resentment too. So I try and cook 1 to 2 times a week in our home. So Jessa definitely does cook more than me, but like the boys and I have the nights where we will get together and we'll cook something new. And yeah, sometimes it is just like scrambled eggs when I'm cooking with the boys. But then I also go out of my way and I try and pick one dish that I come across, you know, on a website or in one of the cookbooks that, you know, I think I get like 10 cookbooks a week sent to my door from all these different publishers. And so it's pretty easy for me to just like open the page and find something that looks good and make it. But Cook together too. Like don't just have one person do the cooking, and don't just step in and kind of cook your own meals every now and again, or be the person that cooks every now and again, but also find things that you can make together. Even if one person makes the salad and the starch, and another person kind of like does the meat dish, whatever, spending time in the kitchen and, like, you know, cooking together and flirting and hanging out, like that's one thing that can really help you out. And you'll learn a lot about nutrition together as well. And one of the things that I notice when people have been married for a while and sometimes will come to me for nutrition or training advice, one of the first things I hear is, well, I'm on board, but my wife isn't, or my family isn't. And a big part of that is because they didn't cook together. Sometimes they don't eat together. They don't enjoy a lot of the same foods together. And eventually there's just this huge disconnect. So just start off by making it a really, really good habit to just cook together and kind of eat a lot of the same things and be on the same bandwagon when it comes to nutrition. The next thing I would say is exercise together when you can. And my wife and I will still do this. Like, we will still go outside in the driveway and, you know, do our sandbags and our kettlebells and lay our little yoga mats out in the driveway next to the car and just, like, do our workout while the kids are out there running around and playing. And it's a great example for the kids. And it also kind of brings us together. We actually, it's almost like our relationship grows the more that we work out together, because Aww. It's just like, you know, we give each other like a big sweaty hug and a high five after the workout. And getting your partner on board with working out with you, rather than having, again, similar to cooking, like, don't have your cooking be just your cooking and your special diet, share it with your spouse. Same thing with working out. If you're kind of doing a similar workout program, maybe even signed up for a similar event or activity, that can really help keep you together. So I've got an article that even has a bunch of partner-based exercises that you can do together. And, I mean, you can do everything from, like, partner carries uphill and then you switch and the other person carries, to partner rows where you're both, like, sitting on a stability ball facing each other with an elastic band, to partner pull-ups where one person is straddling the other person with their arms extended and, you know, that person who's laying down on the ground is doing a pull-up and then you switch. There are all sorts of partner exercises that you can do. I'll link to this article that I wrote over in the show notes with five of them. But partner exercises are really good to do, and it's actually pretty fun to be able to lift, you know, your partner, and it's pretty tough actually to lift like a dead body weight rather than lifting like a, you know, barbell or dumbbell or something like that. And by dead body weight, what I mean is a body weight that you know what I mean.
Yes.
Anyways. Yeah. Hopefully. Don't kill your spouse. Okay. So the next thing that I'd recommend is to plan activities that require physical activity. So we plan things like trips to sky high trampolining, indoor, you know, trampoline, whatever you call them, trampoline stadiums, you know, where you jump around, jump into the foam pits and you play dodgeball and you just bounce around. We do trips to play laser tag. We go up to our LAN and with the kids, we play capture the flag. And these double up as workouts, but they're also activities that we do together. And they go above and beyond just like playing video games or watching a movie or catching up on TV. I mean, even something as simple as, you know, hiking over to the river and jumping in the river and swimming around a little bit and getting out. Like, these are things that if you plan out, and I think I've talked about this before on the podcast, maybe I have, but even sex, like, we'll plan out sex, meaning that morning we'll like make out real quick in the kitchen and, you know, I'll slap her butt at lunch. And it's just like, you're almost like planning and anticipating all day, because if you plan it out, then it's a lot more likely to happen. And the same thing with physical activities and activities that you do together. Like, if you say, you know, in the morning, hey, let's go for a walk or let's go for a hike after dinner, or you plan something like that, you're a lot more likely to do it rather than just like flop on the couch to pull up Hulu or, you know, to watch a movie or whatever. So plan out physical activities so you can break up the routine of just like sitting around. That'd be number three.
You know, for a bit there, I was going to say this is a whole different side of you that I've never seen before, the romantic side, until you said slap her ass as a romantic gesture. And I was like, nope, that's Ben. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Jasmine, you can slap his ass too. So
there you go. Yeah, that fixes it.
So I already alluded to this, but sign up for activities together. Jess and I, usually half a dozen times a year, we're signed up for the same event. Like together, we've already done this year one triathlon and two Spartan events. Just the fact that you're signed up for an event together, whether it's a cycling event or like a CrossFit workout or a local 5K or whatever, that automatically will start to align your physical activity interest and the likelihood that you're going to train together. So ever since we've been married, I don't think a single year has gone by that Jess and I haven't had at least one big event, like a day-long adventure race or a triathlon or something that we're both signed up for, training for together, driving to together, experiencing together. And that's really kept us from growing apart from each other in terms of our physical activity goals. And I just think that, you know, that when you're training for an activity together, you're much more likely to keep your exercise interests kind of aligned. So sign up for an event and get your spouse to sign up for an event too. And that's really important. And then the final thing is, and I just got done writing an entire book about this. It's like a few bucks on Amazon, but get your kids on board once you do have kids and make them a part of exercise. Make them a part of the workout. And at least one workout that we do every week is with the whole family. It's at the park where we're running around like doing, you know, partner carries and push-ups on the park bench and balancing on the fence and, you know, box jumps up and down on the park gazebo. But the kids are in tow with us and making exercise and physical activity and working out, again, part of being a family, that's enormously important. And again, I just see too many people who I counsel and who I consult with who are just like off doing their own thing, and their family is just like, they're almost like, you know, the lone wolf apart from their family because they've signed up for this event on their own. They're like training for an Ironman triathlon, but their family isn't really even interested in triathlons or interested in physical activity. And it's a little sad. And frankly, I think that if you as a newlywed put yourself in this situation where you're planning on getting your kids on board, you're doing events together, you're training together, you're planning physical activity, you're cooking together, then you're going to do a lot better job staying together. And I really, really wish that I could do a Dr. Phil accent because I feel like I was just Dr. Phil. So
I've never seen Dr. Phil, but I do feel like that's something that he would have said.
He kind of has a Southern accent, but I'm not. I probably sound right now more like a scary hick than Dr. Phil. So I'll shut up and we'll move on to the next question.
Hello, Ben and Brock. This is Ignacio from Ontario, Canada. My question is as follows. I keep reading and hearing that a lot of ultra trail runners train based on elevation and time more so that they train based on distance. I'm thinking about training for a 50K trail run, quite hilly actually, and I'm trying to think about what's the best way to incorporate elevation and time rather than distance, and see if this translation is actually possible, because most of the training plans that that you see out there are actually based on distance alone. So if you could help me out in terms of this translation, again, how you can incorporate elevation and time rather than distance for a 50K trail run in a rather hilly terrain. All right. Love the show. Thank you.
You know, Brock, I wasn't quite sure, but do you think he's referring to the Jack Daniels running formula?
It could be. I own that book and I actually got my run coach certification from Jack, but he never talked about elevation in the course.
Well, there's a little bit. I own the drink, by the way. You own the book, and I own the beverage. So Jack
the
Daniels,
formula is simple: open bottle, drink bottle.
Not to be confused with the whiskey. Jack Daniels was a running coach and kind of like, I believe he was a physiologist, but he studied the performances of a bunch of middle distance runners and long distance runners and found that even when their VO2 max, their maximum oxygen utilization varied widely, that you still saw some pretty equivalent performances across the board. And he was able to develop these specific aerobic profiles based on all these different runners' performances and generate these tables that allowed runners, based off of their run performance in like a 5K or a 10K or a marathon, to determine how they would perform at any other race distance and also how they should train. And he called the values that these performances were based on VDOT values. And there are calculators now online. I'll put a link to them in the show notes where you can go to a Jack Daniels running formula calculator and you can plug in, let's say, you know, I'm actually going to go run a community 5K tonight with my family, and I could plug in my time that it takes me to run that 5K, like, you know, 13 minutes. I'm just kidding.
Nice.
So if I really push myself, I'll probably 16 and a half, 17 minutes to run a 5K. Yeah. So what I would do is I could go and I could plug in my times from running that 5K, and the Jack Daniels running calendar or running calculator lets me calculate my training paces. It lets me calculate my race pace. It lets me calculate what my finish time might be in a 10K or in a half marathon or in a marathon based on my time from a 5K. But it also lets you find out what your equivalent finish times at other altitudes for that race would be, or what your training pace should be at other altitudes. So I don't know if you're aware of this, Brock, but the Jack Daniels running calculator now allows you to figure out if you ran a 5K. Let's say you ran a 5K in 20 minutes. Okay. You could not only find out what your training paces should be for, you know, like your speed pace and your endurance pace and your tempo pace, but you could also find out what that pace would be or should be if you're training at 2,000 feet or 3,000 feet, or even a course that has X number of feet of uphills or X number of feet of downhills. And for those of you who are basing this on the metric system, you can also calculate this based on meters instead of feet. So I think that might be what Ignacio is referring to, possibly, because you can actually calculate this based on elevation profiles of where you're going to train and also elevation profiles of where you're going to race.
I can actually see my Jack Daniels running formula book from where I'm standing, but my headphone cord won't reach.
Well, the calculator is actually pretty easy to use. You don't have to read a book. You can just plug your values into the calculator.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if whoever programmed this calculator didn't sort of do an extrapolation on it, because I don't.
Well, let's see. So I'm gonna plug this in. We're gonna do this. This is gonna be great podcasting.
You do that. I'm gonna put my headphones down and go get the book and see if I can find the elevation part.
Okay, so I'm gonna plug in 10 kilometers into this running calculator, and then what I'm going to do is, let's say you could run 10 kilometers in, I don't know, let's say 45 minutes. So we'll say 00.45.00. So 0 hours, 45 minutes, 0 seconds. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to calculate my appropriate training paces. Okay. And then I'm going to click go. Okay. So this tells me now, for my easy or long runs, I should run an 8:55 minute mile. For my marathon pace, if I were going to go out and run a marathon, I'd run a 7:54 minute mile. For my threshold runs, or like intervals that are long intervals, I should run a 7:22 minute mile. For my very hard intervals, like 5 minutes or less, I should run a 6:48 minute mile. And then for like sprints or short distances on the track, like 100 to 400 meters, I should run a 6:24 minute mile. So I can just plug that in and get all my suggested training paces. It's pretty cool. And the elevation stuff is honestly, like, it's probably going to be pretty crappy podcasting if I try and do calculations for elevation on the podcasting. But here's one thing I could do. I could say, okay, let's say I want to run that 10K again, but I'm going to run it in like Park City, Utah. So I'm going to be at whatever, like 8,000 feet. Well, it tells me now that if I can run a 5K or if I can run a 10K in 45 minutes at 8,000 feet, then I could run it at sea level in 42 minutes. I could run it at 10,000 feet in 45 minutes and 34 seconds. It's a pretty cool calculator, honestly, man.
I believe you. I just, I don't think that comes from Jack Daniels.
It does. It does. Oh, you mean like the altitude part of things?
Yeah.
I don't know if the altitude part, but it is the Jack Daniels running calculator online. Oh, wait.
So. Altitude training. There we go.
Boom.
Effects on running performance, loads, other factors.
Would you like to read us that chapter as we sit down?
That'd be awesome.
Grab a glass of scotch.
It's page 56 for those of you following along at home.
I can hear the pages turning.
If your normal training program calls for 70 miles of running per week, there's no reason to vary from that unless your time... Oh, wait. That's not right. Yeah, we won't do that, but it does actually. Yeah, you're right.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. So there you go. Check it out. Jack Daniels running formula. For those of you who are wanting to do this, we'll link to the running calculator online. Great question, Ignacio. Ignacio. That's just a cool name. Sounds like he stepped out of like the 15th century. He's like a painter or a sculptor. Ignacio. Or he's an actor in the Spartan movie. Ignacio. Bring us the swords, Ignacio. All right.
Not
next question.
Anything.
Hey, Ben and Brock, this is Rick in Ohio. I have a question about working out in the afternoon versus the morning. I know from listening to your podcast that it's optimal to work out in the afternoon, but if I can't do that, if I have to work out in the morning, what are the factors that I need to consider to optimize that morning workout? All right. Thanks for the podcast, guys. Love all the content. Take care.
This is a pretty good question. I've actually been forcing myself to work out early in the morning, like 6 a.m., and I freaking hate it. Like, I'm not a morning workout guy. I've been doing it to get ready for that SEAL Fit camp. And there are certain things that I've been doing that I want to share with Rick that allow you to get a good workout if you are going to work out in the morning. But just stepping back and looking at what the best time of day to actually exercise would be, you know, the basic idea here is that we have our sleep and wake cycles, and most of you know that follows this normal daily cycle called a circadian rhythm. And that circadian rhythm is what regulates things like body temperature and blood pressure and production of hormones and alertness and metabolism. And you can kind of sort of reset your circadian rhythm based on environmental cues, like using an alarm clock or establishing certain meal times or even when you work out. So studies have actually been done that have shown that people who consistently exercise in the morning teach their body to be more ready for exercise at that time of the day. And then they actually did a follow-up study with these folks to where when they switched them to evening exercise, they didn't feel like they performed quite as well. Their rating of perceived exertion was higher. So that's really important that any athlete or person who's training for a specific event know that you can adjust your circadian rhythm and how well you do a workout by training at the same time of day that whatever event you're training for is going to occur. So if you do, say, like your marathon training in the morning, you may perform better on race day since most marathons typically start in the morning. So the idea here, though, is that in terms of research on the best time to exercise, the afternoon wins out. Like, your strength is greater in the afternoon. This is all proven by research. Strength is greater by about 5%. Your aerobic capacity or your endurance is about 4% higher in the afternoon. Injuries are less likely to occur in the afternoon because the afternoon is when your body temperature peaks. And your recovery is better in the afternoon because your post-workout protein synthesis, or your ability to use protein for muscle recovery, also peaks. And in addition, evening exercise can help you to sleep better. And they've showed that vigorous exercise is close to a half hour before bedtime doesn't affect sleep or cause you to sleep any less. And evening exercise in most cases actually helps sleep better than morning exercise does. So it's kind of a toss-up. If you're just exercising to stay fit and to get the most out of exercise possible, exercise in the afternoon or the early evening. If you're exercising to prepare for an event, especially if it's an event that, like most events, takes place in the morning, then exercise in the morning. And if you don't get to choose, and let's say that even if you're not training for an event, you just have to exercise in the morning, I definitely have some tips for you for exercising in the morning.
All right. So
here are my 5 morning exercise tips.
You're all about 5 today.
5. It's like Sesame Street. There's only one number in today's episode. This episode is brought to you by the number 5, the letter L, And what's the last thing that they usually devote Sesame Street episodes to? I don't remember. It's like number, letter. I don't remember.
Color?
Anyways, if somebody knows, just write into the show and let us know so that
we
can.
It's been a long time since I watched Sesame Street.
Gather that important piece of knowledge. Okay, so the first thing is that if I know I'm going to do a morning workout, I make sure that I do my heart rate variability measurement before I get out of bed, because for me, part of my morning routine, and my morning routine becomes all the more important if I've got a workout that I'm going to do, part of that routine is measuring my heart rate variability, which allows me to see how strong my nervous system is for that day. So what that means is that if I wake up and my sympathetic nervous system, my fight or flight nervous system, is giving me a really low score, then I know that I may not have all that hot of a sprint-based, weight training-based workout that morning, and I may want to put a little bit more emphasis on aerobics and yoga. And vice versa, if my endurance feedback is a little bit low, I may want to focus more on not overtraining my parasympathetic nervous system and instead focusing on weight training and interval-based training. The other thing I like about heart rate variability training is as you're doing it, you're just like laying there and doing deep breathing and almost like preparing your body. So it's almost like pre-workout meditation, which I'm a big fan of. So the next thing is caffeine is definitely an ergogenic aid when it comes to morning workouts. If I'm going to do a morning workout, it's always better if I wake up and I get the coffee pot going almost right away. So by doing that, you're going to be able to get caffeine into your system. It takes about 20 to 30 minutes in most folks for it to really work its way into the bloodstream and for you to start to feel some of the ergogenic effects. So I definitely recommend caffeine as part of a morning workout if you have the time to squeeze it in. Now, speaking of squeezing stuff in, mm-hmm. let's also talk about squeezing stuff out.
No.
Do you like that segue?
That was nice.
Like the in and the, yeah.
You know what, so, I really like is that you said segue right.
Segue. So the next thing is that it can be tough if you're going to do a hard workout to do it with the poo still inside you. So I would recommend that, and that's another reason to drink the coffee, because that'll help to get stuff moving. But usually if I know I'm going to do a morning workout, while I've got the coffee on, I'll do like some jumping jacks and some hip flexor stretches and like some deep squats, like opening up the hips. Me. Squats really help. But all that stuff to kind of get the poo moving. And if I have very little time, because I've been in places before, like before a race where I know I've just got like – I've got 20 minutes to get to the race and, you know, I got to squeeze stuff out, you know, for a while there, you know, because my bowels are always just like before a race. I'm just like, I don't want anything in there. Right. Yeah. Like I do not want any poo in me when I'm running a marathon of an Ironman triathlon or something like
that. It's like those lizards that poop all over the place before they run away from a predator.
Exactly.
It's good. It's smart.
It's just like, clever go. Guys. So this is going to sound kind of weird, but I've actually found that if you're in a time of need and you just want to go fast, glycerin suppositories work amazingly well. Literally, you can just like, let's say you wake up for an event and your race is at 7 and you wake up at like 5 and you're laying in bed, just maybe like doing your heart rate variability and everything. Just like shove a glycerin suppository up inside you. Wait like 15 minutes. You get up and I mean, like stuff just flows out of you.
Really, that quickly.
Yeah, you don't want to make this like a habit because you don't want to make yourself become dependent on suppositories or whatever. But like for the really hard workouts or for a race, like I say, you know, glycerin is totally natural. It just attracts water into your bowels so you poo. It's not like a pharmaceutical or anything like that. So, I mean, it sounds kind of gross, but it actually works. So if you're just like, okay, I know I'm going to wake up and I'll have like this short 10-minute window to get my poo on and get going, just do that. And it can work as a natural poo enhancer. So the next thing I would recommend, and by the way, there are different kinds of suppositories. Glycerin is the most natural. A lot of the other ones have like pharmaceuticals in them that you're going to absorb that might make you feel a little strange the rest of the day. Mm-hmm. So careful. Choose your suppositories wisely.
Always.
A longer warm-up. Longer warm-up for your morning workout. I find that I usually need at least 10 extra minutes of dynamic arm swings, leg swings, jumping jacks, bodyweight squats, bodyweight push-ups, a bunch of stuff like that before a morning workout compared to just being able to like get up and go in the afternoon or evening because your body temperature is going to be lower in the morning. So plan on a longer warm up if you want a really high quality workout in the morning. Just a basic dynamic warm up. Move in as many directions as possible. Swing your legs and your arms in as many different directions as possible. Do a bunch of bodyweight calisthenics, and that'll really help get the body ready. And then the last thing is after that morning workout, do all of us a favor, because I've had this happen to me at conferences before and before I show up in meetings, cold shower post-morning workout. You do not want to be that person pitted out, you know, sweat all over your brow, red in the face. You know, you look like you just ate a bunch of hot peppers for breakfast because you did your morning workout. So cold shower. And this works any time of day, really. You know, if you've worked out and then you just got to like get, you know, pull on the tie and get to work. I like a 3 to 5 minute cold shower. It's good for recovery. It's good for shutting down inflammation, but it's also really good at kind of keeping the stank off. So
I think it's key too that it's 3 to 5 minutes, because if you take like a shorter cold shower, like if it's only like a minute or a minute and a half, I think your body actually reacts by making you hotter.
I agree.
Like, and you actually sweat harder.
If I just like jump in really quickly, I'm still sweating when I get out. Yeah. But 3 to 5 minutes to me seems like the money zone for to stop the sweat.
Yeah.
And I will literally like turn and direct the cold flow directly onto my armpits, onto my crotch, like any area where you have a bunch of those sweat glands that you know are the stinky kind. I will direct the cold water into those areas so it specifically cools those areas. So those are my tips for you, Rick, for your morning workouts. Do your HRV and your morning breathing, get some caffeine, do a little poo enhancement, do a longer warm-up, and then take a cold shower afterwards.
Hey, Ben Buck, this is Troy from Jacksonville, Florida. I had a quick question on protein fasting. I've read that eating under 15 grams of protein activates certain detox pathways, and I just wanted to get your opinion on it. I really couldn't find any scientific research on it, but I've heard that you should do it once a week. So how often should you do it, if you should do it at all, and what benefits do you get from it? Thanks.
Protein fasting. I'm sure a lot of animals like this approach, that people take this approach.
Oh, I see. I'm like, yeah. What animals don't really think about their diet so much, I don't think. I see.
Fewer tasty animals die.
Yeah. I think pigs probably really appreciate this one.
I think this one originally came from a book called The Protein Cycling Diet. And you can download it for free online. Like if you Google protein cycling diet, you can find it. It's like a free book. But anyways, the idea behind protein cycling is that at some point in our ancestry, our days were governed by the sun. And like in the tropics, the sun is down for like 12 hours every day. And so when there's no fire, there's not a lot to do in the dark except just sleep. So our ancestors likely fasted like 12 hours every night, even if they ate continually through the day. So a 12-hour fast may have been sufficient to induce some of the longevity benefits and the cellular, what's called autophagy or cellular cleaning up benefits of fasting. And
autophagy.
Perhaps our ancestors were already doing some protein fast or some protein cycling or some protein restriction. So in the protein cycling diet, they even recommend like 3 24-hour periods each week where you consume very little protein so that you get some of this activation of the calorie restriction and longevity benefits of avoiding protein. So if you delve into this a little bit more, it might make a little bit of sense, because there are some dangers of excess protein. And in my opinion, there are quite a few people out there, and I know people listening into the show who are doing like eggs and bacon every morning for breakfast, who are kind of overdoing the protein a little bit, kind of getting over and above like that 30%, you know, that I recommend as being the high end of your protein intake. So one of the issues here is that if you are eating too much protein, you can put yourself at risk of what's called protein toxicity. Now, the way that this works is when you break down protein from food, like meat or whey protein or eggs, into energy, your kidneys have to remove a nitrogen from the amino acids that's in that whole protein source. It's called deamination. And when you do that, you get ammonia as a chemical byproduct. And ammonia is actually pretty toxic. Your liver has to convert it into urea, and then that passes out of your body as urine. So eating too much protein can put a little bit of unnecessary stress on your liver and on your kidneys. And in addition, when you're processing ammonia properly requires you to have adequate carbohydrates and adequate fat as what are called cofactors. So if you're overloading your body with protein without these other two macronutrients as a part of the diet, like if you're doing a lot of like lean protein shakes and just like, you know, lots of eggs without any additional like fats or carbohydrates accompanying them, then a lot of times you're going to increase even more the amount of work that you're putting onto your liver and your kidneys. You're not giving your body enough of the fat-soluble micronutrients that it needs as well. And so you can generate some health problems. And actually, the Inuits have this this problem that they refer to as protein toxicity. They call it rabbit starvation. And it wasn't because people or Inuits were eating too much, you know, some people think this is rabbit food, like you're eating lots of carrots and lots of vegetables, and so you're suffering from rabbit starvation. But it actually refers to the consumption of very lean meats, and rabbit is a very lean meat, and you get weakness and you get weight loss and you get this general feeling of illness because you're eating lots of very lean protein in the absence of adequate fats and carbohydrates. Hmm. And so the Inuits called this rabbit starvation, you know, rather than eating like, you know, whatever, whale meat and seal and fish and all this stuff, you know, we're getting that lean meat. And so it can cause some protein toxicity issues. And then the other thing is that periodic protein restriction has been shown in studies to help with this cellular autophagy, which I talked about, which is where your cells kind of do this spring cleaning and clean out old and useless proteins that would otherwise accumulate in your body because your body is having to rely on some of its own proteins for energy. So, you know, the idea behind a protein fast makes some amount of sense, or at least the idea behind not overdoing your protein makes some amount of sense. Now, I recommend that folks get anywhere from 0.55 to 0.7 grams of protein per pound of body weight. And if you're an athlete who's really trying to pile on muscle, about 0.8 grams per pound of body weight. And I haven't seen any evidence that eating more protein than that 0.8 grams per pound is going to help with something like, muscle gain, for example. And I do think that not just a protein fast, but just a general, you know, fast from calories period can be something that can help quite a bit with cellular cleanup on a daily basis. You know, this intermittent fasting approach, you know, these 12-hour overnight fasts or 14-hour overnight fasts. But the caveat is that a lot of people will hear this and they'll be CrossFitters or they'll be triathletes. And so they're combining these intermittent fasts with very tough workouts. That's a quick fast track to hormonal depletion and overtraining. Mm. So I would recommend that you avoid fasting on the days that you're doing very hard workouts, or at least those very hard workouts not occur during your fasting periods. And that if you're going to do this fasting, you do it during a period of time where you're not getting extremely catabolic. So that's something important to bear in mind. The other thing to bear in mind here is that when Troy asks about protein activating detox pathways or lack of protein activating detox pathways, whereas protein fasting can definitely help with cellular cleanup, it's important to understand that the detoxification pathway in your liver, specifically what's called the phase two detoxification pathway, in which you add chemical groups to toxic compounds, so you'll add like glutathione or glycine or taurine or other amino acids to compounds to make compounds less toxic to your bodies, less toxic to your tissues, and make them easier to excrete, that requires you to have amino acids. It requires you to have adequate proteins in order for phase two liver detox to actually occur. So it actually would work in the opposite manner. If you don't have adequate protein, like if you're really restricting amino acids or really restricting protein, then you can actually inhibit these phase two detox pathways. So there's a variety of different phase two detox pathways, but for example, one is called like the glutathione pathway. You know, we hear about glutathione as a detoxing supplement or as a major antioxidant that assists with detox. Well, for that glutathione phase two detoxification pathway to take place, you actually need to have enough essential amino acids on board in order for that to happen. So it's kind of like finding this balance between getting enough protein to support liver detoxification pathways, but not overdoing. And I would say, especially not getting close to like overdoing that 30% of your total daily needs as far as your protein intake. This is also where supplements can help out. I mean, if you're trying to restrict protein and not get too much protein, but also support liver detox pathways and get adequate amino acids for muscle repair and recovery and potentially even muscle building. When you look at amino acids, like if you look at something like master amino pattern capsules, or if you look at something like an amino acid powder, you know, like ThornFX makes the aminos, amino powder. When you look at the net nitrogen utilization, which is how much of that amino acid is actually used for protein synthesis or for liver detox pathways, it's like well over 90%. If you look at a dietary protein supplement like whey protein, for example, it's about 16%. When you look at a steak, it's about 32%. So you're looking at way less nitrogen buildup, way less ammonia buildup from the use of amino acids. And you can literally take like 10 grams, and that's usually like a heaping teaspoon of the powder or a couple teaspoons of the powder or about 10 of the capsules of an amino acid, and you can use that as a complete substitute for a protein-containing meal. And when you look at the actual nitrogen catabolites, and they've measured how much nitrogen is actually kicked off, how much of that toxic ammonia byproduct is kicked off when you use an aminos like this, you get about 84% kicked off from something like a dietary protein supplement, like whey protein or protein powder. You get about 68% kicked off from like steak and chicken and eggs and stuff like that. 1% is kicked off from something like an amino acid capsule or an amino acid powder. So there's literally no issues with renal stress or with hepatic stress. Your kidneys and your liver do just fine, and you get a bunch of extra amino acids for detox pathways and muscle recovery without actually putting yourself at risk of protein toxicity. Cool. So I'm a big fan of just like if you're concerned about protein, or even if you're going to do like a weekly 24-hour fast, or even if you want to do like a daily 12-hour fast but not lose muscle, or you're going to do some protein fasting – have some amino acids around, because you'll get all the benefits of protein fasting without any of the catabolic side effects. So, you know, that's why you could do something like a 24-hour fast, and you could just do like 10 grams of amino acids powders or capsule for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You know, some greens, some water, a little bit of lemon juice for alkalinity, and that's it. That's all you would need during that 24-hour, you know, cleanup fast. So those are some of my thoughts on protein fasting. I think most people overdo protein. I like the idea of intermittent fasting as long as you're not going to do hard workouts while you're doing it. And then I also like the idea of longer fasts or even shorter fasts in people who don't want to lose muscle, but doing it with the use of like amino acid supplements. So,
and that's something that you've recommended in the past for recovering from something like Ironman or a marathon or something like that. Like actually doing a 24-hour fast that includes some green supplements and amino acids.
Well, let me clarify. I haven't recommended that. Oh. Somebody wrote into the show and asked about using that as a strategy, and I actually discouraged it because I think that it's pretty stressful to restrict calories after you've just done like an Ironman or something like that. Like that's mentally hard, and I actually think it's pretty physically stressful to just cut off your body from nutrients. But I do like the idea, once the inflammation has cleared about 1 or 2 weeks later, of since you're going to want some easy days anyways, like taking 1 or 2 easy days and doing a full 24-hour fast just so you get that full quick detox, quick cellular autophagy, and that's where you'd use an approach like this. I also have fat loss clients who I work with, and we'll do a full 24-hour fast every 2 to 4 weeks, and it's really great just for clearing up the liver, assisting with detox pathways without actually stressing the body out too much if you include like amino acids powders and greens and some of the other stuff I talked about. But yeah, I don't recommend it. Like, let me put it this way. If you finish an Ironman triathlon, the last thing you want to do is fast for 24 hours.
Hi, Ben. I really love your podcast. I've been listening for a long time, and I also have your book. But I have a question for you. Ever since university, I've had really bad posture from, like, slumping over at a desk, and it seems really impossible to reverse. I don't know if it's a problem with my lower back muscles being just in disuse or not, but what do you recommend for fixing poor posture? Thanks.
I believe I know a person who just put together a whole poster about something.
I did. That, this is what I presented on at the Ancestral Health Symposium, was like how to kind of biohack the hazards of sitting. And actually, Brock and Rachel, I have 5 tips to help you with bad posture from working on
Ben's
a computer.
Got 5 tips.
So when you're slouching all day, or if you're even standing and you have your hands like over a computer keyboard, what happens is your chest muscles tighten, and that pulls your spine forward, and it rotates your shoulders inward, and this weakens the muscles of your upper back, and it also keeps your chest muscles really tight. So, you know, it's a pretty simple concept, but what you want to do is stretch your chest muscles and strengthen, especially like your upper spine and some of your thoracic stabilizers, to get rid of what is clinically called postural kyphosis. So kyphosis is like kind of like that hunchback type of look that you get when you're just like working all day long hunched over a computer. So some of my favorite moves, stretches, exercises, etc. One would be just a basic doorframe chest stretch. And if you do this one arm at a time, it works even better. Meaning you grab a doorframe and with one arm, you lean into that stretch. Well, that side of your body, you know, the front of your chest stretches. And then you do so for the other side as well. And really for true lengthening to occur, you want to hold that for at least 60 seconds and preferably for about 30 seconds to really get elongation of that tissue. So that'd be one, would be stretching the chest. You also want to do deep tissue work on the on the chest. And the best way to do this is to just get a tennis ball or like one of those deep tissue massage balls. You literally hold it against one side of your chest with both hands, and you roll the massage ball with both hands all around that chest area. You'll feel all the tightness and the adhesions in there. If you do this before you do that stretch that I just described, it's going to be even better because you'll break up some of the soft tissue, you'll loosen things up, you'll warm it up a little bit, and then you do the stretch. So a lot of people don't think about stretching their chest, but that's really, really big. I learned this a couple of years ago when I visited the massage therapist, and like the tightest part of my body, because I spend a lot of time on a computer, was my chest muscles. You know, I thought it'd be like my quads or my hammies or something like that, but it was my chest muscles. So there's that. Plus, I just have a huge chest from all the push-ups I crank out. So there's that too. Keep a foam roller. I talked about the thoracic spine and spine mobility, and the foam roller exercise where you simply lay the foam roller right in the middle of your back, right below your shoulder blades, and roll all up and down that area. If you can get your arms completely overhead like Superman flying through the air, like one hand stacked on top of the other as you do this, you're going to do a really good job opening up the thoracic spine. If you want to do this stretch on steroids, you take a couple of lacrosse balls, you tape them together, and you start with one vertebra about halfway up your back and just roll and work your way all the way up your back, one vertebra at a time, as you just kind of roll around in there, shift from side to side. Again, your arms are stretched over your head, and you're opening up that entire thoracic spine. That works really, really well, and it assists incredibly with upper back mobility. So that would be number 3. Number 4 would be for the shoulders. I mentioned that your shoulders are going to get rotated inward when you're working at your computer, so you want to rotate them outward. So get in the pool, swim lots of butterfly. No, I'm just kidding. Even though that actually would
work.
Kind of sort of work, yeah. What you want to do is
most people can't.
Get in the pool next to your desk and do butterfly. So what you actually want to do is get on the ground on your stomach in like a Superman position. And this is called a prone Y extension. You extend your arms in a Y over your head, and you try and lift as much of your torso off the ground as possible with your arms in a Y. And preferably you can kind of externally rotate your shoulders so your thumbs are like pointed towards the ceiling. You can try this right now if you're listening in, like point your thumbs towards the sky, put your hands in a Y shape. And then imagine like you're lying on your stomach on the ground and you're just lifting your entire torso off the ground while you're in that Y shape and then back down. So It's called a prone Y extension. That one really helps with the shoulder. So we're hitting all the major areas. If you're to do just these five exercises I'm describing, you're going to be money when it comes to your posture. The last one is just a basic close grip row. Seated row, standing row, elastic band row, it doesn't matter. But the idea here is you're rowing with both hands, getting yourself to the point where you have your shoulder blades squeezed together at the end point of that row. You hold that for at least a one count in that shoulder blade squeezed back type of position, as far back as you can go, and then you return back to full extension with the arms. My favorite way to do this, if I'm doing it at the gym, just because I don't like to sit down when I'm at the gym, is I'll go over to one of the cable machines and I'll put it at about chest height and attach two handles to the cable and then just pull the handles until I'm fully rowed and hold that and then let them come back. So just a basic standing row. And you can do this with an elastic band in your office too. You can put it around like a doorknob, or you can like attach it to a doorknob on the outside of the door, close the door. So the elastic tube is kind of like coming through the door. And just row that way. Like, there's all sorts of different ways that you can do a close grip row. But those are the five exercises I'd recommend. A chest stretch against a door frame, some deep tissue massage with a ball on the chest, the upper back foam rolling, especially in the mid spine, the prone Y extension, and then like a close grip row. And when you do that, your entire body is going to look like $1 million. So you don't have to do any other exercises, and you can eat hamburgers all day, stay slumped over your desk, and you're good to go. So
liar. There you go.
Liar. By the way, speaking of lying, should we read one of our 5-star reviews?
Who on earth would give us 5 stars?
We bribe people for reviews. We actually do. Like, crap. If you hear us read your review on the show, then you write into Ben at BenGreenfieldFitness.com, and we send you a gear pack, like a Ben Greenfield Fitness beanie and the BPA-free water bottle and the what else did they get? A shirt. So, yeah, and we actually have a review here from Snack Love, an iTunes review. So what do you think, Brock? Should we fire it out?
I guess so. Did you choose this one because Snack Love has no understanding of punctuation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you get to read it.
So, I'm going to do my... Oh, and there's some interesting spelling as well. Nice. Okay, so Snack Love says, I must say, after listening to this podcast for a few years, it's pretty legit. I had some moments like, who is this Paleolithic fool telling me I can't crush it as a vegan ultra runner dance party enthusiast? But recently, Ben has stepped up his game and insight. Have you?
I guess so.
Just recently. That's good.
Just recently, yeah.
And really is coming with factual, semi-unbiased info.
Semi-unbiased.
Nice. A lot of qualifiers in here. Info you can take or leave. Lots of and peer-reviewed studies and scientific data. I think those are supposed to be ands.
Yeah.
He is... A vibing dude. You're a vibing dude.
I don't know how much weed the Snack Love smoked before he left this.
And does his best not to ego about his awesome lifestyle. What?
Not to be ego about his not awesome lifestyle. Oh, okay. Elevated mind.
To ego with two O's. Yeah. I also like that B&B, I guess that's us, are not shy to talk a little poop and deal with the gut. We did talk a lot about poop today.
And grit of being human.
Yeah. Pretty crazy world.
Pretty crazy world.
There you go.
All right. Despite that being incredibly difficult to read, probably because you're a vegan ultra runner dance party enthusiast, it was
I'd have trouble with punctuation.
Good review.
Too,
it was an entertaining review.
Yeah.
I especially like where he or she calls me a Paleolithic fool.
And you're still going to send a BPA-free bottle, a beanie, and a shirt to Snack Love.
That's right. It just might have like caveman hair and drool on it.
There you go.
But you'll get it. So I think that wraps it up. And I'm not sure that if you're listening in, first of all, you can go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com/291 for all the show notes, everything we talked about, including your glycerin suppositories. And I don't know that we'll have a standard episode next week because I'm headed over to the SealFit Kokoro camp, and I'm not quite sure I'll be able to sneak away from the ocean to record a podcast with Brock, but yeah, we will bring you a riveting episode, and we also have an awesome special secret episode coming up this weekend. You're going to have to stay tuned, but I actually think it's a pretty sweet episode. Should we give folks a clue, Brock, about Saturday's episode?
No. Keep them in the dark.
I'll give them a clue. It's about, the title of it is How an Internet Entrepreneur Went from a Fat Keyboard Slob to Conquering Seal Fit Workouts. So there you go. A timely episode.
Sit with me?
No.
It sounds like me.
You're not a fat keyboard slob. You're a fat podcasting microphone. Oh, that's right. Slob. Yeah. So, anyways, though, thanks for listening. That was awkward. We'll end it here. BenGriefelFitness.com/291 for the show notes, and have a great week.
Visit BenGreenfieldFitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness, nutrition, and performance advice.